Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Anya Attenberg, author of Blue Earth. Anya presents patterns and cycles of social injustice, physical and sexual abuse, and family dysfunction through well-developed characters that intersect with each other throughout the story. Blue Earth exposes these issues as Carver Hines, who loses his farm and family in the farm crisis of the 80s, moves to Minneapolis and rescues a girl from a tornado. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Anya. Anya Attenberg is the award-winning writer of novel Blue Earth, recently published, and the novella The Stories of Devil Girl, both with Modern History Press. Poetry books The Stone of Language and I Know What the Small Girl Knew also are in her track record. She teaches creative writing, works individually with writers, and takes groups of writers, artists, filmmakers, and others to Cuba. She is currently working on the novel History Artist. For more information, you can see her website at www.anyaattenberg.com, and that is ANYAACHTENBERG.com. Hi, Anya. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
Anya, I found your bio to be so interesting, not only because of your background, but also for the commitment that you show on your career to social change. Could you give our listeners a glimpse of where this commitment came from?
Well, I think it was always there, and I'm not sure of all the reasons why. I also know that I came from a family that had suffered a great deal, and in a way that gets perpetuated very often in the family. And so I always had a sense that some people had power and used it badly, and that there was injustice. And for some reason, I think from very young, I don't know that this is good or bad, but I was a little raging maniac about it. Yeah, that it just always was. And I think that, you know, as my life continued, when I did work around things, I tended to find people that, you know, made me feel sane in a society that very often turned its back on injustice.
Yeah, I come also from a place where I grew up in South America, and you could see misery right in your backyard. There weren't really suburbs that we can kind of isolate ourselves, no matter what economic fracture you came
mm-hmm.
from.
Yes.
So when we speak here, though, I've been in the U.S. and for 20 years, but when we speak in the U.S. of current economic chaos, I think that most of us picture words and numbers in our mind, you know, like unemployment and percentages and cost of living. But if we take time to think about what these terms and numbers mean, the picture we get can be horrifying.
Yes.
So why don't we talk about a little bit about what happens when we see that a foreclosure sign? What does that really mean? You know, what will happen to this family, you know, when we see new buildings coming up, big malls where the projects used to be. What are we talking about here?
That whole issue is very clearly it's in the minds of a lot of people now, because many people are experiencing it, and there are literally whole neighborhoods where there's half a dozen foreclosures on every block. And empty homes and homes that have been sitting empty. It's an interesting thing for me because I came from New York City, and the idea of owning anything, but you know, your jeans and your shoes and you know, was a sort of extraordinary thing. People didn't have cars. They certainly didn't own homes or land. And So for me, the whole, you know, and I come from people in who are refugees and in diaspora, and so the whole issue of owning land was something that seemed to me, I mean, it was indeed a dream that seemed absolutely the dream of other people. And my understanding was much more with people who never had anything to be foreclosed on. I think that gives me a view of what's happening. I mean, what's happening now, and one can see that. I live now in Minneapolis, and that one of the reasons I moved here is because there's just something about how many people do have homes, or at least live in a home, as live in a house, as opposed to a crammed in a little apartment. And I guess, and I also live in a neighborhood that is extremely hard hit by foreclosures. And so I guess what I see when I think of it on a certain very visceral level is that once again, being in the street and once again, excuse me, not having a place where one can work, once again, not having a place of any security where you know that's where I'm going to sleep tonight. And so I associate it perhaps a great deal, not with just lost their home, got an apartment, but I associate it with having nowhere to go and being truly marginalized in a way that I utterly agree with you that there's so many people in this country for whom it's only its members, and they don't feel or see what it means to not know where you're going.
Yeah, it's a big detachment, I find, you know, between what we see and read and the actual situation per se, because we're not feeling it. And it's unfortunate. I'm wondering, though, with all this displacement that's going on with people moving out of their neighborhoods into different places because of the economic situation, your book has to do with basically Blue Earth, your book is the title of your book, and I encourage our listeners to check it out. It actually opens with Carver Hines, the character who loses both his farm and the family in the farm crisis of 1980. So I'm wondering, what do you find that's happening with our farm families and communities right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing for me to connect to because I come from, you know, agriculture, and my family was my teacher made me, you know, cut the top of a carrot off and try to plant it. But one thing that drew me here was that landscape of these massive fields and these really extraordinary looking farmhouses and barns, and then the sort of pileup of emptiness that seemed to be happening as people's farms were lost to large companies. I think that, I mean, I there are so many people that I've spoken to who come from farm families, and the sort of leaving the farm has happened for individuals over a long period of time, because for many it got to the point where, no, this is not, I'm not doing this, this is too hard, this is too dangerous, this is too isolating. This is too much a constant battle and worry, and too much, you know, at the whim of weather. And so there were people who were going, but there were so many people who, you know, generationally, this was theirs, and this meant everything, and this is what they did, and this is how they defined themselves, and that. That loss is, I think, part of the loss for many people that of something that they've done that gets sort of subsumed into you know, the corporate.
Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of farm with the communication that we have nowadays, the internet and whatever, their children learn to want other things,
yeah,
and not the family business. And that's exactly what happened to me with my father's business. It wasn't a farm, but it, you know, there was other things that I discovered, mm-hmm, that I was interested in, and that's kind of normal. But in a place, in a type of a lifestyle that is actually dangerous, because there's a lot of injuries that can occur. It's a, yeah, physical job. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? I mean, what types of illnesses and injuries really affect the farm and the, you know,
yeah,
I guess factories that can be put, because they're all manual.
Yeah. I mean, I was sort of, I had a sense, I mean, when I write, I tend to write first, and I mean, I tend to write from something that I've connected to, but then do a lot of research after there's a lot of the draft in place. And my sense was that that terrible things happen on the farm, and I'd heard things, and that sort of came out in early writing. But as I researched, I was really pretty horrified. There are for instance, in a lot of farm areas, there are sort of local, in the local clinics, they got so used to reattaching limbs.
Wow.
That it was, you know, they got good at it. But that whole, you know, that whole question of the kinds of machinery, when you see this stuff, it's extraordinarily intimidating, extraordinarily sort of massive in a sense, and unstoppable. It has something about these machines, something about it that's unstoppable. So in addition to whatever adult farmers and everyone would go through, of course, there's an enormous amount of many, 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 many children who grow up working. And so they are very often the ones that are somehow caught, that it's complete accident, or they are working and they are caught in some way by the machinery. It's also just a very, very hard life.
Yeah, and you're I'm picturing a really grim also lifestyle, in the sense that, and its effects can go and affect everybody, because I imagine, I mean, farming is really the heart of our food source.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, you know, if they're battling the weather, they're battling injuries, and they're battling as well economic downfall. So I'm wondering, you know, I mean, let's talk about a little bit about what the value of these products and it's for our health. I mean,
yeah,
what's going to happen if they all fall down? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, I mean, I think that it's part of that that movement where nutrition is controlled by massive companies, and that's, I mean, the whole question of where the farmland came from is another very important question. But I think that all of us suffer by the you know, these farms being brought under this huge corporate control, because the level of genetically modified food, you know, is going up. That power to even infect, in a sense, there are smaller farmers, there are farmers that are working very hard to produce food that's organic, that's not genetically modified. And of course we hear about how those seeds kind of float, you know, the wind does not stop at the dividing line of ownership. And so a lot of those seeds kind of infect the crops of farmers that are working for it, their stuff to not be genetically modified. And so it's a very difficult thing, but I think it most definitely affects our nutrition, because it becomes more and more something taken out of our hands. And I mean, the story of corn, for instance, is I can't even keep up, because at least now so much is coming out in terms of Monsanto's role and all, and just the battle for our sort of basic right to have healthy food.
And let me tell you, I came from Venezuela 20 years ago, and I remember I could eat anything. And after the first month that I lived in the U.S., I gained 10 pounds just by eating the same things that I was eating before. And I am 100% sure that it was because I was not eating organic. I was just eating anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a supermarket and not paying attention, thinking it was all the same.
Yeah.
And it's not. I didn't feel the difference right away. And when my relatives come, I have relatives in Italy as well, come, and they live in the small towns and they grow a lot of their own stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they feel the difference right away.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Basically.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through Direct Podcast, as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Anya Ottenberg, author of Blue Earth. Stay tuned, because we are going to continue this very interesting and thought-provoking conversation with Anya and learn more about family displacement, social injustice, and societal crime. But in the meantime, you can check out her book, Blue Earth, by visiting her website at www.anyaottenberg.com. And that is ANYAACHTENBERG.com. I wonder how a lot of these problems that we're having with our women and our girls today, you know, that they're it's hard to control your weight, you know. I mean,
yes.
You know, I mean, a young girl could be so active, and, you know, it's just a consequence of, I think, of a bunch of things happening together. Nowadays, we're not as active as before because we have the computers and the TV.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the food makes us gain weight easier and fast.
Yes.
Excuse me, and faster.
Yes.
So, and to make things worse, superficial judgment of the girls is something that has happened forever.
Yeah.
Now we judge how we look. So, what do you think about that?
Well, I wanna talk about that question of that superficial judgment. I just want to a kind of aside, but it goes directly to that. I live in a neighborhood that's considered pretty much one of the poorest neighborhoods in Minneapolis and one of the most crime-ridden. And I know inner city stores from New York as well, where you couldn't buy a vegetable that looked like it had been picked, you know, in any recent history, you know, at all. And here in the grocery store, and people are judged very badly for, you know, well, it's because of people's choices. Even if you're poor, you can eat this way, you can eat that way. Well, here you are in this neighborhood where there are no jobs, where there's massive numbers of foreclosures. And when you go into, there's a grocery nearby me, and sometimes I run in there, though usually I travel to get to the grocery. You come in and you're led down this ridiculously, you can't just bypass this because then you can't get in the store. This long, 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 long corridor with food piled up on either side, and it's all processed food. It's all heavily sugared food and white starches, and it's all, and there's a million things, and it's like everywhere you look, and you have to go down this aisle to even get into the store, where there are sort of like, it's the whole produce department is sort of like some guy set up three crates, you know, that he grew in his window boxes, and there's, you know, there's a few vegetables. So, you know, that it's, things are really incredibly unequal in terms of what's even available. And
it's horrible.
Yeah, and of course, even what we're supposed to eat, it's still, there are people who are hyper aware, and so we're educated. I tend to try and be aware because I don't have health care insurance, so that's my a good part of my insurance. But so I've seen it. I worked, for instance, with dropout youth in New York, and my students would come in starving because they didn't have any money. And so and by lunch, they would eat anything put in front of them, and what was put in front of them was dreadful. And as well, if they had a dollar and a half, they would get a Coca-Cola and chips, and that's what you get for a dollar and a half.
And if you look at what's in the soup kitchen, you know,
mm-hmm.
when the first place that you visit as a family having economical trouble,
yes.
it's a soup kitchen or a soup or pantry, a community pantry.
Yes.
And what can they store there if not processed foods?
Right.
Just cans and cans and more cans and
right.
boxes. So
yeah.
I see where you have a very valid point.
Yeah. Though there are so many movements, right? Even here in Minneapolis, I've been hearing that there's going to be some brigades picking, because there are lots of people who are growing stuff that they can't use, or they have apple trees and the apples just fall relentlessly to the ground and nobody eats them. So there are people, you know, working. It's a drop in the bucket, but it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. People working to sort of get those, you know, all of that extra produce and get it to people who can use it. So, I mean, I think globally as well that it's not a question so much of not growing enough food, but of the distribution of food.
Yeah, it's the availability for everybody.
Yeah.
The problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I went to your website, and I would like to tell our listeners to visit it because I found it very interesting.
Thank you.
And the website is aniaachtenberg.com, and let me spell it for you. It's aniaachtenberg.com. I was reading a little bit of all the good stuff you have there, and I realized that you've done a lot of social change writing or in a foundation or something like that came about, and there's a lot of background in your bio about societal crimes against certain groups and racism and sexism, violence. I mean, where did it all come from, too?
well,
are you drawing from your own life of what you've seen in the places that you live?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, New York, wherever you go to school or don't, you get an education. If you have thin skin, which I do, it's not only crimes against you, but the crimes that you see against people around you that just go right into your system. It's funny. My mind is sort of leaping out of itself, going like, yeah, well, you don't want to think about that. But indeed, yes. And being there were I was myself homeless for long periods and I understand. I mean, and then I've worked with so many people and young people and adults as well, who have had long periods of very disturbing kinds of conditions in their life
You always wonder why. Why is this? Why are these social crimes, coming about? Why is there so much violence against women? And I can't find an answer.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think that there's. Part of what I seem to be moved by to write in general, and it's certainly a very central issue in this novel, Blue Earth, is the question of historical amnesia and of putting away of not just not being educated, but being in a real state of denial about what happened, where things come from, the source of wealth, the source of, you know, of our ways of treating each other, the perpetuation of things that are extremely old, that sort of forgetting even the original reasons, but you know, constantly manufacturing, for instance, more reasons why women are supposed to be inferior, or those folks are inferior, or those folks need to be controlled, or so I think that part of the violence will utterly and absolutely continue. And we see it certainly globally with certain, well, certainly there's the basic aspect of profound greed. And I think profound greed is certainly for money and land and everything in terms of material privilege. But I think that those people who are at a very, very top level that are moved by that profound greed, that it's also some sort of abscess of their being, that the greed is also for finding themselves to be God, finding themselves in a position where they have power over any and all. Because it's simple greed for things, you know, you can't spend $60 billion. You can't eat it. You can't live in it. You can't, no matter what you do, you can't spend that much. And the idea that, you know, that there are families that want to perpetuate this privilege and wealth for their own children, well, it's interesting because the irony of that is that many of those families contribute to the extraordinary destruction of the environment, so that, you know, their generations are not going to be as privileged.
It's such a vicious cycle, and I think you gave a really good term, which is historical amnesia, like that. And I think that goes hand in hand with the profound greed as well. And it's just crazy. We forget, you know. There's so many consequences to because of greed, you know, whether it is wars that come about. And, you know, I grew up with parents that were survivors of World War II. So in my household, it didn't matter whether my father was doing good or not doing so good in certain times. As I grew up economically, we never threw away anything.
Right.
You know, I mean, something broke down, we would just fix it, and I mean, the toaster's not working. Well, let's see why not, and fix it before we thought about getting a new one.
Yeah.
But I see that things have changed. I mean, even people that don't have that economical power, they're just buying things and using them as disposable, and that's bad for our environment, but that makes those profound greed companies more wealthy.
I think as well that it mirrors how people are treated, and that there's that idea of who is disposable, under what circumstances they're disposable. I do think that relates to the way that women are treated, that everything has its function. So if your phone has, you know, 10 functions and suddenly it can only perform 8, or it dropped and it's not as pretty or whatever it is, you know, you get a new one. And I think that, you know, part of our historical amnesia is to forget that wealth, that beauty, that grand palaces, that you know, beautiful textiles, that all of the things, that the jewels, you know, we know about blood diamonds, that you know, beauty of a certain kind very often is built on, comes from, is raised from the blood and the suffering of some people. And, you know, there are people that, if, you know, if one mentions these things, they get very annoyed. Oh, come on, it's just a such and such. I guess so, but it depends, you know, what side of the trough you've been on. If you've been feeding well, forever if you don't want to remember the source of, for instance, in this country. The massive facts of the world of exploitation, of slavery, of colonialization, all of these massive facts of the labor of women,
mm-hmm.
of child labor, and of child slavery and of current, you know, sort of the profound sort of network of prostitution and pornography, of how people are kidnapped into it and or have no other avenue. I mean, it's not, you know, I have a life where I laugh and I dance and I do these things, but it's certainly not a forgettable fact. And having been in enough of a difficult life and painful life, it's, you know, I'm more amazed at, you know, people who don't ever want to look, you know, at the source of what they have.
I wonder, and we're getting close to the end of the show, but I wonder, I mean, you're so wise, and I really hope a lot of young people listen to this interview. What would you say to the youth of today? You know, I mean, is there any way that we can change how things are? Is it too late?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if I'm wise, but I'm definitely jealous, because the youth today have, I mean, I am not a Luddite. I love my computer. I now love my Android. I had like a really crappy phone for a long time, but I find it extraordinary that I can go into my computer and hear radio from anywhere in the world, that I can read articles about what's going on anywhere in the world, that I have a range, as much as, you know, I feel media fails so much in the United States, but I can go on and read, you know, absolutely the most penetrating analyses of everything. I'd rather read a novel, because I'm just your flaky artist type, you know. but so I'm quite jealous, because there are extraordinary possibilities, and there are people through. I mean, I find that power of the internet is really, I mean, there's a lot of really doofy things on it, but there's just that extraordinary stuff. I mean, I still remember that there was a boy who was about 10 or 11 who started doing things around. He was very disturbed learning that there were children basically enslaved. And he started, I don't remember his name, but he's continued to do that work, to get to places in India and to help to work to get, you know, children out of working in brick factories at the age of 8 and get them into school. And, you know, there are, I mean, everything is so overwhelmingly difficult. But if young people find, you know, this is the thing that draws me, that moves me, I'm going to do something, there are many, many, many opportunities. And the only thing that I mean, one of the caveats that I want to mention, though, is a lot of people do. I mean, I'm very connected to Cuba for a lot of reasons, and I do work around Cuba, and I'm very tied to communities here, and I'm tied to communities there. I know young people who decide that their lot is doing something in somewhere in Africa or somewhere in a village here, and I just want to say that sometimes it does become, it's just more interesting and wonderful to do something in what is to them an exotic locale, and to never cross the river, to never go over to the neighborhood nearby, and never bring your consciousness there to try and understand what, you know, what your own country is doing as well within.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we always have to look at how conditions here and conditions elsewhere are tied. Who's considered expendable? What's being lost? What's being destroyed? And also as well to never, never assume, how can I say this delicately, but a sort of the vision of the missionary, because when you come from down and you really know people, you know that there is genius. There's extraordinary will. There's extraordinary beauty of every kind. There's amazing talent everywhere. And you're, you know, if you come from privilege and you imagine that others do not possess what you possess because they don't have, you know, your material wealth, it's not true. So when one enters the world, you know, you enter it as a partner, and you probably learn much more than you ever teach.
Well said. And you know, let's use the internet for good by learning things not only on the rest of the remainder of the world, but also locally, like you said, because all the information is there. And you know, instead of using it to disconnect ourselves from reality, yeah, let's use it on the other hand,
yeah,
to connect us back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very well said. I find this interview so inspiring. I want to thank you so much,
Connie. Thank you so much.
And listeners, her book is Blue Earth, and by Anya Achtenberg. And I really suggest you visit her website. It's AnyaAchtenberg.com. And again, it's AnyaAchtenberg.com. Thank you so much again, Anya.
Thank you.
And listeners, until next time.